Hey there, I'm Raquel O'Brien and you're listening to Unfiltered, a production from Casefile Presents where we invite people from all walks of life to share real stories about justice and transformation. We're bringing in a range of perspectives in an invitation for you to make up your own mind. Coercive control describes a pattern of behavior used by a perpetrator to gain power in a relationship. To do so, they erode their partner's autonomy and self-worth. These behaviors create invisible chains that trap the victim in the relationship, scared to stay and terrified to leave. When I started looking into my own history of abuse, the first light bulb moment I had was learning about the concept of grooming. Grooming is a tactic used by sexual predators to lure children into a web of coercion, deceit, and shame. Once I understood the mechanisms of grooming, I was able to free myself from the web. In my opinion, when it comes to domestic violence, the concept of coercive control should be central to the discussion. For that reason, I'm joined by award-winning criminal behavioural analyst and expert on domestic violence, Laura Richards, who helps decode the mechanisms of coercive control. Laura, you are one woman, but really you are this multi-dimensional force when it comes to contextualizing certain types of violent crimes. I thought we could start on a personal note, and I'm wondering if you could provide a little backstory of the journey that has led you to become a criminal behavioral analyst and a world-leading victims advocate for sexual violence, domestic violence, stalking, homicide, the list goes on.
Yes, well, hi, Raquel, and it's lovely to speak with you finally. And I've listened to your podcast, your story, and I just want to pay tribute to you, kudos to you for telling your story in your own words when you felt that you were ready, because I know that will help many, many people. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
So yes, where did I start? Well, I guess, you know, a long time ago, I probably read too many Nancy Drew stories and Hardy Boys and watched a lot of law-related shows. And that's where I really thought I would probably end up. And then various experiences in my own life shaped me in thinking about inequality and abuse within my family, abuse outside the family. And I decided that what I really wanted to do was start to analyze and profile cases. And because I was a people watcher, I really wanted to study psychology to begin with. And I ended up asking numerous detectives who I'd come across, the younger me, about how do you work at New Scotland Yard? And are there any units that take on students? Because I was studying psychology and I ended up being able to secure what was called a college-based sandwich student position, which didn't mean I made sandwiches, which a lot of police officers thought that that's what I was doing, although I had to do a lot of things in that role. But it meant that I had 1 year in between my finals and finishing my first degree in psychology and sociology. And I worked in their sexual offences section up in the intelligence branch in New Scotland Yard, which was a very new unit set up in the wake of a very high-profile case, a man called Peter Sutcliffe, who was targeting women outside the home and raping and killing them. And my unit, the sexual offences section, was really the response to that, all the failings of how he slipped under the radar. And I had responsibility within that unit of profiling stranger rape, murder and abduction cases. So the cases people worry about the most. But what I learned was that most of the men that we were identifying had histories of domestic abuse, of offending within their home environment. And that made me very curious. Curiosity has always been my thing, which is why I talk about being curious and asking questions. And I wanted to know more about those men. So it's really been a journey, and I'm still on it now, 27, 28 years on.
Yes, and now I've heard you say across the world, the home is the most dangerous place for women and children. I know this to be true in my own experience. And when I decided to investigate, become curious really about what I endured as a child, one of the first light bulb moments I had was learning about grooming, because it really helped me understand the environment that my perpetrator had created to make those crimes he committed against me possible. And as you and I both know, Laura, grooming is a control tactic many child sex predators use to lure and trap their victims, but also the victims' loved ones, into this spider web of silence, denial, and shame. And I say this because I'm particularly interested in the non-physical aspects of abuse. You're someone who's worked directly with thousands of victims, survivors of domestic violence, and you speak a lot about coercive control in these cases. So I would like to know if you could shine a light, please, on what coercive control is.
Yes, well, I think you've articulated it very well, actually, because the spider's web analogy is what I use a lot. The web that is invisible to many people, even to you when you're in it, you don't understand the concentric circles around you that keep you entrapped and keep you silent and keep you looking inwardly to your own self for why you did X, why you did Y, and the blame and the burden that sits with you. If you do articulate it, others may also direct the focus onto you. Well, why did you do X? Or why did you do Y? Well, why did you go with him? Well, why didn't you say something? So society and our culture also projects it back onto you rather than saying, well, why did he do that? So that is part of the spider web, that it's not just in a vacuum that this happens. And coercive control for me is about an unfreedom. Now, if we think about that, an unfreedom, it's how particularly women and girls become entrapped and exploited, and we have our resources and support network taken away, and that only leads us to further introspection, and at times will push us closer to the perpetrator, because in an ironic way, they're the only ones who understand our experience, particularly if we try and articulate it outwardly and people don't understand that. So really at the heart of coercive control is a power imbalance. And that means it can happen anywhere to anyone where there is a power imbalance. And therefore, when we think about how that occurs to individuals, but on a, not just the micro, the macro level, how do girls and women get there? Well, it starts with girls feeling that they have to be polite, kind, compassionate, and responsible for other people's feelings.
Right.
And that we have to push our own needs down to put other people's needs first. That power imbalance happens from a very young age, where girls are taught that they're second-class citizens and that we only exist in as an extension to a boy or a man, and it happens from very early on. So it's not as simple as just unpicking what it means in a vacuum of a relationship. We have to look at the micro and the macro to really understand how girls and women get there, if we take the power imbalance first of all, and that is at the heart of the coercive control offence.
And it's interesting because it doesn't look a certain way. It's very individual, right? It depends on who it is and it can show itself in various ways, right?
Absolutely. It's idiosyncratic. And that's always a long word that I use, but it basically means it's tailor-made. It's bespoke.
It's tailor-made, exactly.
It's personal to you. So whatever you value, whatever is important to you, whoever is important to you, those things will be monopolized, manipulated, and exploited. That's why you don't see the same case repeat over and over again. You have to look at what's happening in that individual context, but also understand the macro of what's going on around that person.
Exactly. And I did read on your website that approximately 51% of victims do not even know that they are being abused, manipulated, and controlled, which really made me think about how coercively controlling behavior erodes victims, autonomy, and really their sense of self. So it's a bit of a philosophical question that I've asked myself so much. And it's, when our sense of self is stripped and stolen from us, who do we become?
Yes, we often become the mirror image of those who are abusing us. And we take on their inner narrative and we spout that back out to people. And in that sense, we then defend them because that is the narrative that we take on. And when we think about children in particular, because it's really important we think about children, they don't have the language. They don't know that that behaviour is unhealthy, abusive. They don't have that language in their repertoire. And that's why it's so important to watch their behaviour, to understand what's happening for them, because they won't be able to articulate it. And that, again, is about power imbalance and how children are much easily exploited because they don't have that language and they just trust willingly.
Yes.
They do, because the adult or the older person will hold that power. Whereas a woman who already has formed her views, her values, her ethical considerations, her likes and her dislikes, that can be a more sophisticated type of grooming where that is eroded over time and their autonomy with their self-esteem is eroded over time and replaced with the perpetrator's narrative, with their desires, with their wishes, with their wants.
Yes. And you were mentioning before that so often the conversation is directed at, why as a victim did you let this happen? Why didn't you speak? Why this? Why that? Why that? Victim blaming chronically happens. So you analyze these crimes from a behavioral and preventative perspective. So how can we create a profile of who these offenders are and how they often show up in the world? Is there a way to diagnose that?
Well, a simple way of looking at how they show up in the world is control. Mm. If there's a need for that power and control and domination in one aspect of their life, you will see that translate across all aspects of their life.
Right.
It might not be as visible. It may be less visible in certain aspects of their life, but in my experience, it will be there. So if you take someone like Dennis Rader, who was a serial killer, where his wife didn't talk about him abusing her, but he did. He coercively controlled her and others, and he abused and killed many others outside of his home environment. But some of the questions I asked about his behaviour when I was working at the FBI was, well, what was going on in his everyday life? And I discovered that he would measure the blades of grass, measure them so that they were all at a certain height. And he would have these rules and regulations that he brought in with a fear of consequence if those rules and regulations weren't met. So he is king in his own kingdom and everyone must play to his desires, wants and needs. That's how it shows up.
I've heard you mention as well charming, perpetrators being charming in society. And I resonated with that because my father was a very charming person. So what can you tell me about that aspect as well?
Yes, they may well be charming. And charm disarms, as I always say. Charm is very much a decision. It's a choice. And we all use that charm, all of us, to get what we want, to get our needs met at different times. So it's, to what degree do they use that as a manipulator and to what end? It's very different using your charm to get nice treatment when you're at a counter to buy something and a positive experience versus trying to charm a child or a woman into a lulled sense of security to be able to exploit them and entrap them and abuse them. It's a very different aim and end. So yes, lots of different tactics can be used. That's not to say all coercive controllers are charming, but a lot of them are. And therefore it makes it very difficult for people to believe that they did X or Y. And too often we all fall into that trap. Well, he seems like a nice guy to me. I mean, he treats me, the minute that statement's made, it negates whoever has made an allegation, it negates their experience just by, well, he's a great guy to me. And that, again, we must challenge ourselves when we start to position a perpetrator by saying, well, he's great to me, ergo, he didn't do that to her or to him. The two things are not the same. And we must understand that the manipulator, the charm tactic, could well be at play.
I think that's an excellent point, and it really touches on our societal responsibility to identify the red flags of abusive behaviour, because the onus cannot be placed solely on victims, and sometimes I feel like it is. In practical terms, coming from your technical expertise here, how can we as a society better identify the red flags of abuse and high-risk behaviour? I'm thinking more about preventing it before it goes to the worst case scenario, do you know?
Yes, and for me, all of my work is centered around A, listening very carefully to what a victim, before they're a survivor, they're a victim, to their experience, the language that they use. Does it mirror the perpetrator's? Because if it does, that tells me that there is most likely coercive control there. So the language is really important. It's important in identifying the red flags. And the actions, the behaviours are also important. Is the language and are the behaviours congruent? So I'll give you an example of how the red flags can be excused away. And it happens a lot in childhood where girls and boys are valued differently. So a little girl's behaviour is held to a much higher standard than a boy's. And if a boy is acting out, and I'll give you an example, it's a case that I'm looking at the moment. It's of a cold case murder that was recently solved, and the perpetrator did not have a history of convictions for violence or abuse. There was one assault, and on the face of it, you can think, well, it's just one assault. So did he really do this double murder that was violent and brutal? And the initial detective thought, well, it can't be him because he has no history. He went and spoke to the family. The two sisters said, when Bill was younger, he would kick us or he would touch us up sexually. And when we told our mom, she said, well, that's just Bill. He's just experimenting. Well, he didn't mean it. That's just Bill. Mm-hmm. The whole family had these shared experiences of how he was violent, abusive. His friend, because he only had one, would say that he was mean to girls, mean to women. These are the sorts of red flags. And by the way, he did kill Tanya von Cullenberg, and Jay Cook was her boyfriend's name. It was a double homicide in Canada, and it was solved 30 plus years later. But these are the sorts of histories that I see being ignored time and time again. And I've spent my career collecting these dangerous men that I look back to their childhoods. It's called a psychological autopsy, to look for those clues, to look for those signs and what I call the red flags. And it's often the same thing that just repeats over and over. And more so in every serial killer case, I see the same red flags, those things in their childhood, whether it be someone like Levi Belfield, whether it be somebody like Jerry Brudos here in the US, Ted Bundy. Mm-hmm. You can take any case, Robert Knapper in the UK, who killed Samantha and Jasmine Bissett and Rachel Nickell and Wimbledon Common. His mother and sister reported him peeping on them, the sexual behaviour in his childhood, and yet that was excused. It's just
boys being boys.
Boys being boys, exactly. And those behaviours we must pick up on early on. And then looking at how they have relationships with women as they get older, you will see those behaviours repeat, and we would call it domestic abuse. But much more, it's about coercive control and how they will manipulate, how they want to absolutely entrap, how they want to dominate because it makes them feel powerful. So it's not writing everybody off who shows those behaviours at a young age. It's ensuring that we wrap an intervention around them.
Exactly. An early intervention, right? Because there are early
yes.
signs. Exactly.
The earlier we identify it, what it tells me, if a little boy, and a friend of mine recently, she's a teacher, asked me about something that happened at the school that she worked in, where she said a little girl had tummy ache. All her friends were sad for her and they put their arm around her. But this one little boy went straight up to her and punched her in the stomach.
No.
And she asked me, well, what do you think about that, Laura? And I said, well, you watch children at play every day. You're calling me to discuss it. So you're obviously concerned. What do you think about it?
Trust your instincts.
Trust your instincts. Ask the question, but trust your instinct. It's not a normal response. Ergo, whatever that little boy is experiencing at home, he is a sponge. He's a mirror. He's just reflecting those behaviors in his own everyday relationships. So the earlier we get in and work with him, the far more likely it is that we can work with him to ensure that he has healthy responses and healthy relationships. But more so, we must be looking at what's going on in his home. There's something happening there with an adult, and we need to be looking at them.
That really speaks to the cyclical nature of abuse, which I did want to ask you about, because oftentimes we find that perpetrators were often victims at some point in their childhood, often again in this home environment. And another thing that you mentioned before that I think is super important is the research that you did where you found offenders who assault strangers often perpetuate abuse in their home environment as well. For me, that was a huge revelation because it tells us they're one in the same. We're looking for the same people.
We are. And that was research I conducted at New Scotland Yard and I published on it. And it makes no sense to think stranger danger, gold standard response versus what's going on in the home. Well, it's just a domestic. It makes no sense.
Yes.
So those sorts of training sessions for me are so valuable that I still deliver. I will get up early in the morning to deliver those sessions to professionals to make sure that they understand the behavior, because too often professionals are trained as if violence and abuse happens in a vacuum. Well, that's child abuse, that's domestic violence, that's sexual abuse, that's a missing person, that's a serial killer case, that's a sex offender. Where actually we need to be looking at what the person's doing as a whole. And we need to be thinking about families, because rapists and serial killers, they don't grow off trees, i.e. they don't just wake up one morning to decide to do what they do. So that means if we walk it back, believe children when they say what's happening to them, believe them and take them seriously, ask questions about it. In my experience, children don't make things up. When they're talking and they are role-playing or they know things sexually, that there's no other way that they can know that other than if something happened to them, then we must take that seriously. And the same when women come forward and they say that my partner, my husband did A, B or C. Well, if they're willing to do that to the most significant person in their lives, I always say, what are they willing to do to someone they don't care about? Because these are power and control crimes. So that's why we must ask more questions and be curious and not come from the position that women and children are making things up and that they're not credible. And that is also the victim blame of looking at them and picking their behavior apart. That's also something that is just, you know, where it comes from. Well, we can talk about that, but you know, any professional listening to this, or any mum, dad, sister, brother, best friend, think about your own judgment and that little voice in your head of how you look at somebody when they report to you that something's happened to them. What's your first question that you ask? Because oftentimes it's a victim blame judgment first.
Yeah, and that's because we're conditioned to think that way. Maybe we can go into the why of that, or in your opinion, the why of that.
Well, yes, I mean, I've done a lot of thinking about this, of where does this come from? And I'm still, every time I work on a case or I'm involved with, even listen to somebody's experience, I always have those questions in my head. Does what I think map out? Does it map across? And having worked in the police and listened to so many police officers immediately cast judgment and dispersions on women who report, you know, where does that come from? It's this instant mistrust of women, and it is so ingrained and deep-seated. Where does that come from? Well, if we think about books that are written, or if we think historically about stories that are told, we think about Adam and Eve. It was Eve that did the bad thing.
Yeah, she committed the first sin. Yeah.
She committed the first sin. If we think about Pandora's box, who opened the box? Well, it was Pandora, a woman, and Helen of Troy started the war. And we start to get an understanding that women in history are written up as women who cannot be trusted, that we They're not credible and they're dangerous. Now, these stories are written by men.
Of course.
Of course they are. So that conditioning happens even when we look back in history about, and we read stories or we're listening to people talk about religion. Those stories are so ingrained that they are imprinted on us at every level to think about, she cannot be believed. And we don't even know it happens at such a subconscious and deep level. So again, we have to challenge our own conditioning and how we bring up children and those stories that we tell them and what they see on the screen, in the movies, you know, even to that level where when you have a character that's written by a man, that's a woman, the nuance is missed. When crimes are told about male, you know, by male podcasters or written up in the newspapers, well, in the newspapers, 80% of the crime reporters are men.
Yes.
So then again, the nuance gets missed, right? And I learned this from many cases and talking about cases at New Scotland Yard, training officers. And then when I came to Hollywood, and I was really curious about that, of how many times are stories, women's stories told by men. And if they haven't experienced it, they don't understand it, they don't bring in a consultant to help them, then they're only going to be telling about 20% of the story. And when Chris Goffard told the story of Dirty John and Deborah Newell, when I said to him, you know, the case is about coercive control, he said, I've never heard of that before. What is it? And I explained what coercive control was. And he said, wow, if I had known that, I probably would have told her story differently. And that's a powerful, I mean, Chris Goffard is a very thoughtful person. And I thought that was a very interesting utterance from him. He would have told the story differently. And that's the truth, ultimately, that you don't understand somebody else's experience. And how could a man really understand a woman's experience of being coercively controlled? It's just not possible. The same as I couldn't tell the story of one of my friends who is black here in LA, who got put down on the ground by LAPD just for cycling on his bike whilst being black. I haven't lived that experience. So I wouldn't write about it or put it into a movie unless I had him talking me through all the nuanced detail of that. And that, again, is about understanding people's perspective and not being arrogant that you know someone else's experience and that you can tell their story better than them.
Unfiltered will be back shortly. Thank you for supporting us by listening to this episode's sponsors. Thank you for listening to this episode's ads. By supporting our sponsors, you support Unfiltered to continue to deliver quality content. And you speak about not including the nuance of these stories, and I so often feel like it's lost in the act. We're focusing on the acts themselves and not the context. And to focus on the context, you need to be able to understand grooming and coercive control. And Laura, you've spearheaded domestic violence law reform campaigns to criminalize coercive control in both the UK, the US, and more recently in my home country, Australia. As an expert on the matter, why is it important to criminalize coercive control?
Yes, and I've worked alongside some incredible survivors, campaigners, all across the world. And so many of us feel that it's really important for our lived experience to be taken into account in the laws. Now, laws and systems and processes historically have been created by men, for men, to protect men. That's the number one reason why it's important, that our experience must be taken into account and laws must be modernised, they must be updated to reflect women and children's lived experience. It's not even in this order, but they're all important things. The pattern must be taken into account. You know, if I could ban a word in the police system and in the criminal justice system, it would be the word incident. Because the minute someone says they're attending the incident, they're thinking they're dealing with something that's a one-off event.
Totally. Totally.
And it's not. Our experience is that it's over and over and over again. And so therefore, that totality of what's happening must be taken into account. And having criminalised stalking, we do it with stalking, we do it with other crime types, so there's no reason why it cannot be done with coercive control. And other reasons are that the violence model doesn't work, and we know that it doesn't work. So we don't just get to violence overnight. We have all the non-physical tactics that happen prior. And that's why it's so important for non-physical events to be visible in our laws and our legislation. And if we want to get into early identification, intervention and prevention, we must codify it in criminal justice systems as well as family justice systems. And if we understand that femicide, well, coercive control significantly correlates with femicide and familicide when women and children are killed by men. And in New South Wales, for example, looking at 112 homicides, they're actually femicides and familicides, coercive control occurred within 111 of those cases, 99%. And we have to get into it earlier to understand that it's patterned, to enable us to change the culture of only reacting or taking someone seriously when we see something physical that's happened, the black eye, the broken bones. And women and children's experiences, I mean, I've listened to thousands and thousands will say the broken bones, the black eye isn't the worst part.
Exactly, the psychological scars.
Absolutely, that aren't visible to anybody. So the minute I hear someone say, well, he never hit her or he never physically hurt her, I know that they are just understanding the top surface of what's going on. They have no understanding of the grooming, the conditioning, the manipulation, the psychological harms, the emotional harms that happen. And that's what we need to change.
They're not really understanding anything at all, if that's the question that they ask. I think, you know, people really demonstrate their level of understanding within the first question they ask in these questions. And it's very true. We need to ask ourselves the first questions we're asking ourselves. And look, I know that in 2015, England and Wales became the first nations in the world to criminalise such controlling behaviour within relationships. What are some of the results we're seeing from this change in legislation 7 years on?
Well, England and Wales, I mean, I'm very proud to have pioneered and spearheaded that law reform campaign. And I did so after the stalking law because it was the elephant in the room, you know, that still when I was running Paladin, the National Stalking Advocacy Service, we were still seeing every time there was a domestic abuse case that everything that was non-physical was not being taken into account up until the point of separation. And then there was escalation, then stalking, and then, oh, well, it's a crime now. So coercive control, the law reform, the campaign was the most successful in the history of Parliament. It was a 12-month campaign. We produced overwhelming evidence to make it so compelling that the law should be changed. However, one of the requests that I asked of Parliament was to ensure that there were mandatory training prior to the law coming in, and that didn't happen. So Scotland, it did happen. They did get money to deliver training before their law came in. Now, why I say those two things prior to answering your question is that it's a really important part of bringing a new law in that people are trained on it, because any law is only as good as those who are interpreting it. So some of the good things we've seen is the zeitgeist, the culture has changed, that people are talking about coercive control, that it's become a common term in our lexicon in England and Wales, because we put it in TV shows, we put it in the Archer show, across lots of different multimedia platforms, as well as changing law. But the training in police, in the courts, in the criminal justice system has been very slow, and that has had an impact. So we have seen an increase in offences. It went from around 400,000 in 2012-13 when the law first came in. Sorry, in, I should say, 2015, the stalking law came in 12, and 400,000 around 2015-16. And of the last year, or 2021 to 2022, it's gone up to over 900,000 reports of coercive control. So in terms of reporting rates, it's increased, and it's in our lexicon. People now understand more. I'm not saying that they understand as well as they should what coercive control is, but we haven't seen the charges and conviction rates increase at the same levels. And so that tells me that we need to be doing far more. Well, I already knew that before. That's not a light bulb moment, and shouldn't be, because training is such an important part of this. But we need to make sure more people are being put before the courts. And what we do know about those who are, it's about 99% who are male perpetrators. And what's interesting is that when it's a female perpetrator, the sentences are far longer. When it's a male perpetrator, the sentences are lesser. Now, that's not saying that the female perpetrator sentences are wrong. They are as they should be. What it tells us is there is a gender and a sex bias, and therefore we need to ensure that we call out misogyny and the sexism, and that is a far bigger piece of work. That doesn't just happen with the advent of a new piece of legislation. But one of the very positive unintended consequences of cases like Sally Challen, where the law was used in her appeal. She was convicted for murder of her husband. She had been coercively controlled and abused from the age of 15 to 56, and that wasn't put before the court as part of her defence, and she got a 28-year sentence for murder, which is almost unheard of in terms of the most serious end of sentencing. And so the coercive control law and her post-traumatic stress was put before the appeal court, and her conviction was vacated. And she had already served 9 years, which is much more than what most male perpetrators would serve. But the Crown Prosecution Service didn't decide to go for a new trial because she had already served those 9 years. So again, it can be used in cases, the coercive control law, to show where coercive control was present. And that's a positive, unintended consequence. But there's still a lot more work to be done around training and implementation.
Yeah, well, that's so interesting. And you mentioned Scotland. I read somewhere that the most common penalty was non-carceral divisionary programs in the case of Scotland when the legislation was changed. And I wanted to get your thoughts on community-based solutions like offender treatment programs and carceral solutions like prison time when it comes to penalizing abusive behavior.
Yes, and I think that, you know, Scotland, for example, they have had far more cases within the first year of criminalising and second year and perpetrators being put before the court, which is great. That tells me about training, how effective their training is, of training police, courts and so on. So that's important. The question that you ask, well, it depends on each individual case. But what I will say is that those who use coercive control, in my professional experience, are the most dangerous of perpetrators.
Yes.
If they are using it across serial victims, multiple victims. And most serial killers were behaving in a coercively controlling way to their partners. And yes, many of them are married, which always surprises people because of that misconception that they're lone males who live alone or live with mum. That is a complete misconception. There are a number of those men, but that again...
But they're not the majority.
They're not the majority, exactly. And therefore we struggle to understand when we have someone who's charming, who's a family man, who's got children, that they could be capable of doing what their victims have told us they have done. So for me, I would like to see the psychopathy checklist being used because many of these individuals are psychopaths and they're flying under the radar. And what we do know about them is that if they go to prison, prison is far more effective for these individuals than any other type of perpetrator.
Mm.
And someone may be thinking, oh, well, that's interesting. I wonder why that is.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's quite simple, actually, as to why it is. It's because their power and control is taken away from them. And they don't like it when their power and control is taken away, when their autonomy is taken away. Therefore, they're much more likely to change their behaviour based on the fact that they don't want to go back to prison. So we have to think about fear of consequence. You know, why is holding someone accountable and responsible and having a fear of consequence important? Well, it's important because that will be the only reason that they will change their behaviour.
Look, that's provided some real food for thought for me, that point, because I have come across an argument. When we're talking about the context of Australia, there was a First Nations-led backlash against the Queensland effort to criminalise coercive control. The argument was that Indigenous women are often misidentified and treated as offenders by the police. And now I'm thinking about it comes back to training, as you're saying, rather than being treated as victims. So therefore, criminalising coercive control would result in more Indigenous women being imprisoned rather than protected. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, the first thing is that we have to recognise that, yes, racism plays a part, right, in our cultures, in our systems, in our processes, and by professionals. No law is going to solve that problem on its own.
Yes.
But that's not a good enough reason to say that you won't legislate to protect. What you have to think about is with all these isms, sexism, racism, misogyny, misogynoir that we see, is how do we take steps to challenge that and hold those individuals to account? That's a bigger piece of work. And the training is absolutely vital. The quality of the training, i.e. expert-led training, not a police officer who talks about road traffic accidents one day and then domestic abuse and coercive control another. It has to be specialists and expert-led training delivered by the groups of specialists and experts so that we understand racism and sexism and misogyny, and we're not afraid to call it out when we're delivering that training, and we're not afraid to talk about the patriarchy when we're delivering that training, because that power imbalance is at the heart of the coercive control offence. So the coercive control law, in my humble opinion, is a first step in the right direction where we can get into those conversations, but we won't solve it overnight because this is built on centuries of exploitation of, you know, and racism and sexism and misogyny. And it's so systemic and it's so ingrained. So it's going to take some time to unravel all of that. But when you have a trainer, and this is something I see all across the world, oftentimes you have a trainer who says that they're an expert in domestic abuse and they don't even mention structural inequalities. They don't talk about patriarchy. They don't talk about misogyny. They don't talk about racism. How can you possibly train someone in a vacuum as if this relationship happens just between two people? That's all that it is. And it's not all the other structured inequalities that keep that person entrapped or silenced. So there's a huge amount of work to do, but I don't believe that that is on its own a reason why progress should be stalled and stopped.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And as you said, how important it is to take into account the intersections of identity, all of these isms that we speak on, and that bringing that into the conversation. And we've got a long way to go, and that's part of progress. As you say, we can't stop something because other things aren't being done.
There's never going to be a perfect world where those things are eradicated. And so when I hear other experts say we're not ready for it, I always say, well, if not now, then when? Because when will your perfect world exist? It ain't going to exist until we make that happen. We have to keep making these steps, these progressive steps forward, where our experiences are at the centre of law reform, where there is the expert-led training, but there's also policy and implementation, and there's oversight. So when we have a case where somebody has misinterpreted the law, or when a marginalised individual has, where Gabby Petito is seen as the perpetrator and not as the victim, where's the oversight? Where's the challenge? Well, that's where the supervisors come in. That's why you need to have scrutiny panels. You need to layer in these other key checks and balances to ensure that you haven't got the dominant group still stigmatizing and exploiting and entrapping those who are at the bottom of the power equation. So it can be done, but it has to be thoughtful. And I think that's the point. If you rush something, then you're more likely to get it wrong. But you can still have a positive unintended consequence, like we did in England and Wales for Sally Challen. So I think what's being done in Australia is there has been a slower consultation. Well, many consultation processes. When we think about New South Wales, you know, 8+, all these different roundtables, you have to take everybody's experience and thoughts and opinions into consideration. But I always go back to, if not now, then when?
Yes, and something that's so important in shifting the culture surrounding this, as we've mentioned many times through our conversation, is returning the conversation to victim-centered narratives. And when I listen to you speak, I really appreciate how you always bring it back to a survivor-centered narrative. And I wanted to share that from my perspective as someone who's told their story, I believe it's super important to not only share our stories, but to do so in an honest way where we actively debunk the perfect victim narrative. And I say that because when I was originally wanting to share, I found myself trying to not be totally honest because I was trying to protect myself from the judgment that I knew I would receive. And part of that was I decided to share my story and include the chapter of how I became physically abusive in my first intimate relationship. Now, it was and still is extremely difficult for me to confront, share, and overcome that rage that stemmed from my own abuse but was manifesting as abusive behavior. Yet, I rarely, if ever, hear this part of the narrative being spoken about. Laura, my question is it just me or do you see this trend when you're dealing with other survivors?
Yes, and the non-perfect victim, that's all of us. There is no such thing as the perfect victim. And so you having that conversation and being honest about how multi-layered and complicated it is when you've been victimized, and the anger and the rage, that is a shared experience across most victims. I never say always, because you know, people do find different tactics, techniques, coping mechanisms, have other people around them at different times to support them, but that the journey of unprocessed trauma, it can manifest in rage. And that's why when looking at each person's experience, we must expect it to be different. We must expect that there will be times where someone may lash out, where it may be reactive, and understanding what's underpinning, what's motivating that behavior. Because even in the situation where you have women who may lash out, who may react, who may even goad, what I often see is that it's not about trying to dominate and entrap the other person. It's not about trying to damage them. It's an expression of emotion and feeling and rage against the machine, of all of those things that have happened to them. And that's why it's so important that we ask questions when we see and hear that happening. And we don't just label people as the abuser, but asking questions about that patterning of behavior is so important. And getting away from this, they must be a perfect victim. If you're a victim of a burglary, we don't ask about their history and that, you know, they have to be the perfect victim to be believed. But what's ironic is that when someone reports sexual abuse or domestic abuse, in people's heads, they have to be the perfect victim and have never done anything as an expression of that abuse. And women do, and they will, and children do, and they will. So that's why, again, I go back to being curious, asking questions, and trusting your instinct, and not falling into this sort of trope of what, and I hear this all the time, what a victim would be like, what they would do, and she would never do this if she were a real victim. So again, the questions and being trauma-informed, I think, are really at the heart of how we respond to victims. And, you know, again, for the little boy who punches the girl, what's that an expression of? So oftentimes, and I think this again is where we see the sex bias, is that the boy's behavior is excused. We find every reason for why But for the girl, somehow we don't look for every reason why, and we don't ask those questions. There's a much quicker rush to judge that she's, and I've seen this across my career, that she's the abuser, she's a pathological liar, she's a narcissist, she's a psychopath.
Yes.
The way that we label girls and women, that even when she sees help in the medical world, well, she has BPD, borderline personality disorder, rather than actually she may have trauma.
Yes.
And her trauma response is what we're seeing. Even the histrionic personality disorder, it doesn't exist. It's not a thing. It's the waste paper basket for when women act in a way that men don't understand. Well, who comes up with these disorders? Who comes up with these things? Men, male psychiatrists and psychologists, if women don't behave a certain way. So I'm not in the business of writing anybody off when there's an expression that is uncomfortable or difficult or violent. We have to get underneath that and find out where that's coming from. And most oftentimes what I see is trauma.
Yeah. Yes, right. Deep-seated trauma that often we don't understand. And I really wanted to thank you for sharing your insight. I know myself, I've learned so much from this 1 hour that we've spent together. And I wanted to finish with a final shout out to your podcast, Real Crime Profile, and Crime Analyst. I'm suspect, but I really, really, really love Crime Analyst because it's these things you encourage your audience to be curious, ask questions, and trust their instincts. And I know that each time I listen to an episode, I feel like I've gained clarity and I also have 100 more questions. So it's this dichotomy. I'm like, oh, I know something. And then I know, oh, I need to know so much more kind of vibe. So what encouraged you to birth this project with everything else you had going on, you have going on?
Yes, it probably wasn't the smartest idea, being pregnant and giving birth, but also launching a podcast at the same time. But sometimes these things happen and they coincide. But my two babies, as I call them, Rafi being one of them and Crime Analyst the other.
Awesome.
I really wanted the freedom of being able to talk about things, talk about abuse, talk about cases in long form under my own terms, taking the conversation in the direction that I feel is helpful. And I wanted to platform victims, survivors, families, and I wanted people to hear from those who've experienced things firsthand. And that's Crime Analyst is all about raising awareness. It's all about educating and moving the needle and creating change with the victims, survivors, experience right at the center of it. And if a case takes me 20 parts, it takes me 20 parts. I wanted people to understand, the evolution of when I work a case, that you don't always know where you're going to end up. When I'm analysing case material, for example, like Gabby's case, the police stop, you don't know all the different bits of material information you're going to have. And I wanted people to understand what goes into my work as well, the detail, the devil's in the detail, as I always say, the nuance, the context, really at the granular detail. I wanted to bring that to bear on, the podcast so that people can hear how my thoughts get formed and hopefully we all end up in a better place from it. And I certainly have incredibly, amazing listeners who let me know how it's impacted them. And most oftentimes it's for the better of where we end up. And hopefully I've solved some cases in the process too, because
yes,
some of the cold cases and older cases of giving them a new perspective, the contemporary female lens, which I think is really important from an expert perspective, I believe it is what's needed in a lot of cases when we're talking about male violence to women and girls.
Thank you so much again, Laura, for all that you do and all that you are. You really help instill hope for a brighter future, and we can't underestimate the power of hope in these conversations. So thank you.
Thank you. Yes, hope is something that's very important. And as I say to a lot of victims, you will get there one day. There is life after this. And I think that's a really important message, isn't it? As you've shown yourself that there, you can move from post-traumatic stress. And oftentimes it's not even post, but you move through and you can go from survivor to thriver and do incredible things in your life.
Right. And I'm like 3 years into, I say I was reborn 3 years ago, and I say I didn't even know what it was to experience joy like I am now able to experience. And I always try to remind others who are not quite there that it is possible. And when it happens, it's even better than you can ever imagine, because joy as an emotion that's not plagued by post-traumatic stress is just, it's life, you know, and it exists.
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. And I'm witnessing it firsthand looking at you. So thank you so much for your time. Thank you for telling your story and helping so many people. And thank you for asking me great questions and talking with me. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Unfiltered. You can visit Laura's website at thelaurarichards.com. To better understand coercive control, Laura's podcast, Crime Analyst, has some great episodes on the topic. Links are available in our show notes.